Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Breast cancer is the leading cause of cancer-related death among women, but women are less likely to die of breast cancer than even a decade ago. This positive trend, however, does not reach to every demographic. Even as the rate of death from breast cancer among women shrinks, the disparity in survival rates between white and black women grows. Black women are more likely than white women to die of breast cancer, a lot more likely. In Franklin County, black women are dying for breast cancer at a rate 33% higher than white women. Allison Payton provides breast cancer education to African American women as the program coordinator for the Pink Pathways program at the Ohio Health Research and Innovation Institute. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also with us by phone is epidemiologist and the director of breast and gynecological cancer surveillance at the American Cancer Society, Carol DeSantis. Carol has studied racial disparities in breast cancer. Carol DeSantis, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Carol, for decades, black women were less likely to get breast cancer compared to white women. What's changed?
Well, what has happened is that the risk of breast cancer in black women has been slowly increasing, and the risk in white women has maintained, been about the same. And as a result, what's happened recently is that the rates of breast cancer in black and white women have converged. So now, black women are just as likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer as white women.
Why has that rate then slowly increased over time?
Well, I mean, we don't know exactly what is causing that. One theory is that it reflects increases in risk factors, particularly obesity, that increasing obesity in black women may be part of what's driving the increased risk of breast cancer.
And again, we're talking about diagnosis first and then death rates second. How does breast cancer affect black women differently than white women?
Well, so black women are, there are different subtypes of breast cancer, and black women have twice the rate of one of the most aggressive subtypes called triple negative breast cancer.
Well, okay, so we know that there's the two times the rate, but again, we don't know exactly why black women have two times the rate of that.
Correct.
Okay. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the rates of breast cancer and the disparity of rates of breast cancer between white women and black women in the United States, just as well as much the case here in Franklin County. You just heard from Carol DeSantis. She's an epidemiologist and director of breast and gynecological cancer surveillance at the American Cancer Society. Also with us, Allison Payton, program coordinator for the Pink Pathways program for African-American women at Ohio Health. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Allison, obviously, if there's something called a Pink Pathways program for African-American women, that suggests that, you know, the likes of Ohio Health certainly acknowledges this is a big problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they fully support the Pink Pathways program.
What do you do?
Well, Pink Pathways is a community navigation program. It provides women with education about breast cancer. It connects them to screening mammograms, and it also provides them with resources, guidance, and support.
What are you finding that women aren't getting that you're giving them? I mean, you're giving them all of that, but don't they already have access to all of that?
Not necessarily. They don't. They don't always necessarily have access to it. Some of them are uninsured or underinsured, and are basically uncertain about what their insurance will cover. And if they don't have insurance, can they get a mammogram at all? Mm-hmm. So we're really offering them that encouragement, that guidance, and that resource to say, you know, if these are issues for you, we can step in and provide you, connect you with a program that can remove those barriers.
And how are you reaching out to the community? Where do your tentacles go?
Usually to any organization that works with African-American women is who I'm reaching out to. So I'm working with churches, working with beauty salons, places that African-American are going on a routine, regular basis they're familiar with and they're very comfortable with.
Are they aware of this problem when you talk to them?
Some are and
some
are not.
They must know a lot of people who are dying.
Yeah, some are and some are not. You know, there's a lot of confusion around breast cancer, the screening recommendation. Should I get a mammogram? How often should I get it?
Yeah.
So I've noticed that.
And Carol DeSantis, one reason some have said for this problem or this disparity, I should say, is that Black women are often diagnosed later. Why is that?
That is true, that Black women are more likely to be diagnosed with advanced stage breast cancer. Though screening rates appear to be similar between Black and white women, there's a lot of research to suggest that there are differences in quality of mammography, as well as timely follow-up after an abnormal mammogram. And even though overall rates between Black and white women seem to be similar and fairly high, there are definitely pockets of women, underserved women, that have a lot of barriers and are not getting screened clearly. And a lot of what's driving the disparity is our socioeconomic differences and poverty and just barriers and access to care.
When you mention those things, the timely follow-up makes a lot of sense. It's hard enough to get to a mammogram and then to have to do a follow-up mammogram at a special time at a special place often. But what about the quality of mammograms? Why would there be a difference in the quality?
There's research to suggest that it does matter where you get your mammogram and who reads it, what the qualifications. If you have a radiologist reading a mammogram that only reads mammograms as opposed to a general radiologist, that might be looking at all sorts of x-rays. So the quality does vary.
Allison Payton, from where Ohio Health sits on all of this, if I go to get a mammogram at Ohio Health, how are they looking at the quality of care?
Well, one thing that we've been doing here recently, Anne, is we've been taking our mobile mammography unit out into the community to these women. So we're offering those services right in a location where they live, work, and play, basically.
And that's as good of a unit as anyone's going to get anywhere?
Absolutely. It's like a freestanding healthcare facility. Yep, and our techs are on there, and they're providing those women with those mammograms, and so that's something that we know is high quality.
And are they partaking of it?
Yes, they are. So far, the reception has been very well received in the community, and women are actually very thankful that we're bringing those services out to them, somewhere that's convenient for them.
What about the follow-up issue? Obviously, we mentioned the economics of it. It's hard just to even, the transportation alone, mm-hmm. it can be. But what are women thinking when they hear that? Is fear a part of it, too?
Absolutely. Fear, definitely. Just fear of, how will I pay for this if there is something found? How will I have the time to take care of this and get back to the doctor? And just the competing priorities that these women face.
The American Society of Clinical Oncology in Chicago reported that Black women who learn that they have a high genetic risk of ovarian and breast cancer are less likely than white or Hispanic women to have their healthy ovaries or breasts removed to lower their risk of developing those cancers. Carol, can you talk about why that is? What's going on there?
Well, I'm not familiar with that study exactly, but I would say there's definitely differences in access to treatment. And as I said before, socioeconomic differences are driving a lot of this. One of the big drivers in disparities is access to quality treatment. And there's been so many treatment advances for both the hormone receptor positive breast cancers as well as the HER2 positive breast cancers. And what's happening and why the death rates in Black women are not decreasing as fast as they are in white women is that not all women are getting access to this treatment.
Have you seen any similar trends in Asian or Hispanic groups?
Well, breast cancer death rates are lower in Asian and Hispanic women. Risk of breast cancer is much lower in both of those groups. And Asian women, in all groups of women, death rates are declining. But they're declining fastest in white women, which is causing these disparities. So everyone is seeing progress, but, the progress is not being received equally among all groups of women.
How much do you think that education will help?
I think that education is a big part of it, and patient navigation and these programs that get into the community can really benefit women. There are so many barriers that keep women from, you know, getting their mammogram or getting follow-up, and then getting treatment. Some of these treatments, tamoxifen, you know, you're talking 5 to 10 years of staying on medication with side effects. You have to pay for the medication. So there needs to be support.
What kind of support is there out there in Franklin County, Allison Payton?
Well, there's definitely support with the Pink Pathways program. I mean, we have women that call in and they do need to have their mammogram scheduled. And, you know, scheduling it and actually getting to that mammogram is a different story.
So how do you help them that way?
So it's just really that personal touch. I call them. Some of them ask me to call them. Can you call me? I know I'm going to be nervous. I don't want to go. Can you just call me day of? Even if it means going to the appointment with them. If they need me there, just for that moral support.
So you bring the mobile mammography unit out. Mm-hmm. You do a raft of mammograms, and a couple of them pop up with questions. How do they get to those follow-up appointments?
Well, from what I've seen so far, we have yet to have that happen.
Okay.
Since I've started the program and started. We would be in touch with those women and follow up with them, make sure that they are getting their appointment scheduled. Making sure that they're keeping up with those appointments that they're going by giving those reminder phone calls and encouraging them and just seeing if there are any barriers that they're having to getting there. And whatever they are, we can remove those.
What do you tell somebody who can't take off work?
It's just one of those things. It's something that I don't know. I don't know. That's a hard one to answer, you know, when a woman cannot get off work to go and get this much needed follow up care. It's difficult.
Or as Carol DeSantis mentioned, the 2 or 3 or 4 years of treatments that are involved with side effects.
Mm-hmm.
Has that come up yet?
No, it hasn't. But one thing about Pink Pathways, I've met a lot of wonderful survivors who have been through these experiences. So they're there and they're ready and they're willing and able to talk with women because they've been through it personally.
Yeah.
So that's one avenue for women that, you know, may say, I don't think I can do this. This is too long. Years I'm looking at here. To be able to talk to a survivor and to give them their story and how they did it, how they managed it is something that could be helpful.
The issue of economic disparity pops up in a different way that you mentioned, Carol DeSantis, and that is in lifestyle. There's more stresses. There's worse diets. There's less exercise, that kind of a thing, right?
That's correct, yes. And, you know, research has shown that that's one of the drivers for disparities in breast cancer. If you have other comorbid health conditions, diabetes, hypertension, you know, that's going to affect your survival from breast cancer as well, your ability to tolerate treatment. So that puts some women at a disadvantage there. So certainly, you know, anything as a society that we're doing and, you know, individual choices to increase health, healthy diets, active physical activity, having an active, healthy life is going to benefit both your risk of getting breast cancer and then after diagnosis, your survival.
We have an email from Carl who asks, can someone talk about the new digital mammogram? Carol DeSantis?
So digital mammography has largely replaced the old film screen mammography. That's not really, that's what the current mammography standards are now.
Okay.
It's all digital.
It is all digital. And is it considered better? Or I guess if it's replaced it, I guess the assumption is that it's better.
It's definitely better. And I believe these mobile mammography units, what happens is they take the digital mammogram, and Allison, correct me if I'm wrong, but and then they send it to, you know, just an electronic file can be sent to a radiologist at the local hospital who can then read and interpret.
Is there any disparity depending on where you live, whether it's a rural area or an urban area? Does that matter?
I mean, it certainly matters. There's some recent interesting study that looked at breast cancer trends and death rates and found – they looked at this by county, and they found some counties the disparities were widening. Most counties, the disparities were widening or staying the same, persisting. But in a few, 10% of counties, the disparities were narrowing, and some, the death rates were similar between black and white women. So that's really a hopeful message that, I mean, it's upsetting that there are so many persistent disparities, but that it is possible to attain health equity. And then now going back and looking at those counties that have been able to do that and finding out, what they've done, what works, is really hopeful that these disparities are not inevitable, that progress can be made.
Carol DeSantis, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's Carol DeSantis. She's an epidemiologist and the director of breast and gynecological cancer surveillance at the American Cancer Society. Also, Allison Payton, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
Allison Payton is the program coordinator for the Pink Pathways Program for African American Women at the Ohio Health Research and Innovation Institute. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I got it. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Singer George Michael died recently of natural causes related to heart disease and fatty liver, a condition most probably associate with drugs and alcohol. But there's another fatty liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, that is just as deadly and affects as many as one-third of Americans, including more than 6 million children. Kristen Kirkpatrick is a registered dietitian and the manager for the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute. She's also the author of a new book entitled Skinny Liver, a proven program to prevent and reverse the new silent epidemic, fatty liver disease. She joins us by phone. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me here, Anne.
Why is this a new epidemic?
Well, I guess I would say it's quasi-new. I think it's been around for a while and definitely brewing, but I think it's new to most people because it's just starting to get the attention that it deserves. We're just starting to see really a much higher prevalence of it, much more people getting diagnosed with this, and individuals looking for treatment. So it's not necessarily that it's new, but I think the epidemic portion of it is new because now we're just kind of recognizing that it's impacting so many people.
So the main causes of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is what we eat and what we don't do with our bodies.
Right. Yeah, it's a lack of activity. It's poor dietary choices. Our weight has a huge factor in it as well. Very, very much a lifestyle-related condition.
What parts of the body are directly affected by the liver? How does the fatty liver disease affect other organs?
Well, that's the thing about the liver, and this is really one of the reasons why I wrote the book. It's just such an underappreciated organ. The liver really has so many functions that people don't recognize, and what happens is when you start having fat accumulation in the liver, and the liver can't really do its job as well, and let's say it progresses to some of the latter forms of the disease, the liver can't do all of the things that it does on a daily basis that we don't even think about. So that could be things like processing and metabolizing carbohydrates. It could be clearing ammonia from the blood when we have protein sources. It could be a huge liver thing that is actually taking toxins out of the body when we have toxins in the body, which comes in our body every day from many different sources. So really, I would say every organ is impacted, and that's why I think this is such an important condition to really pay attention to now.
You've written that liver diseases are often overlooked because symptoms don't show up in the early stages. Are there ways people can catch it in the early stages?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, just going to see your doctor once a year, I mean, that's something that we know not every individual does. So just having that annual exam, if your doctor does take blood tests, just regular routine blood tests, then your liver enzymes sometimes will show up in those blood tests. And if you have elevated liver enzymes along with, let's say, some other symptoms, perhaps you're overweight or obese, that may make your doctor to say, you know, you probably might have a little bit of fatty liver disease. Your doctor may then require an ultrasound. That's sometimes the second step. Many of the physicians that I work with at Cleveland Clinic, however, will simply look at these elevated blood enzyme numbers for your liver and look at other things that are going on and then send the patient to me to kind of look at dietary approaches and weight loss before they go to that extra step of ultrasound.
I'm kind of wondering how much the issue of fatty, how much progress has been made on studying fatty liver disease because of the hepatitis epidemic and how much has been learned about livers, the liver from that.
Right. There's definitely more trials now. So if we look at some of the clinical trials that are going on, and obviously as for me as a dietitian, I'm very interested in clinical trials that are looking at things like fish oil and things of that nature. We definitely have an increase in clinical trial because really we have not had very comprehensive guidelines like we do with diabetes, like we do have with heart disease, on how people should truly treat this and reverse this condition. A lot of times people are simply told to lose weight, and that's the majority of my patients. They'll walk in and say, well, my doctor just told me lose weight, right? And there's no other detail there, but there's nothing that's necessarily specific to the liver. It's always just specific to weight loss. And yes, they go hand in hand, but we can always look at things that actually strengthen the liver. And so I think that some of these clinical trials that we see increasing, and keep in mind as well, I mean, fatty liver disease could potentially overtake hepatitis as the number one reason for liver transplantation in the next 20 years. So there's need for clinical trials, and I do think we're seeing increases in that as well.
You know, you said that a lot of this is due to the fact that we're just getting better at screening for it and finding it, finding those elevated liver enzymes, for example, in blood samples is a big way of doing that. But we also eat a lot more stuff that's very hard on the liver, and alcohol's not, is one of those, of course, but this is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. What else is in our diet that is so hard on the liver?
Well, I'd say one of the main things is sugar, without a doubt. In fact, one of the scientists that I quoted in the book once said that sugar was alcohol without the buzz. And it was so true because when you look at how sugar is metabolized, obviously we have different forms of sugar that we take in from different food sources. But fructose in particular, and I'm not talking about fructose from fruit, but I'm talking about fructose that we find in soda, in some processed items, cakes, cookies, etc., that can only be metabolized by the liver. It's like the one organ that knows how to metabolize and process fructose. So while I won't go as far as saying that sugar is the number one reason and number one cause that we see such an increase in this disease, I think our intake of sugar has definitely contributed to it. And I see this with my patients. I mean, sugar obviously comes in the obvious sources, gummy bears, things like that. But I think a lot of people are taking it in less obvious sources and not realizing it. So,
well, like their spaghetti sauce or something like that?
Right. Your salad dressing, your spaghetti sauce, things of that nature. So I think as long as Americans still have this sweet tooth, and we definitely do, much more than other countries, I think, if we continue to have this sweet tooth and we continue to feed that beast, we can continue to want sugar. And so that is very taxing on the liver, and this condition is very closely tied to things like diabetes and heart disease and things of that nature. So I think that anything that's going to impact those diseases is also going to impact your propensity to develop non-alcoholic fatty liver disease as well.
Do you call that, when it's socially often associated with something else, comorbidity?
It's somewhat of a comorbidity, and in my book I refer to it as a piggyback condition. So, for example, if you look at some of the studies of individuals with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, a huge percentage of them also has diabetes, right? And you can look at it from the opposite standpoint. If you have type 2 diabetes and you're overweight, the chances of you also having fatty liver disease are huge, ginormous.
And is the treatment of something like diabetes affect the treatment of fatty liver, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease?
Yeah, I think they're very much, they're very closely related. I think that a treatment for diabetes is very beneficial to the liver because of the process that the liver has in terms of storing glucose and how it metabolizes glucose. Insulin resistance is very tied to this as well. So not to say that this is a diabetic diet in any means, But I think that individuals that are seeing a dietitian or their physician and being treated for diabetes and weight loss at the same time, if they're doing it correctly, can for sure impact the liver positively as well.
Of course, anybody that's being treated for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is what we're talking about right now, should talk to their doctor before they change their diet, all things being equal. But you do talk about, you know, you have recipes in this book. What is a diet that you prescribe?
So the diet that I prescribe is really looking at foods that are very what I would call liver friendly. So, for example, one of the things that we talk a lot about in the book is having a lot of color. So with color, and color usually comes in the form of plants, not in licorice, things like that, right? but with color, typically we get much more higher amounts of phytonutrients, antioxidants, et cetera. And we know that those things do help with reversal and treatment of the disease. We don't get enough color as Americans. I always joke to people that I have a son that I struggle to get fruits and vegetables in him. And so instead of talking about fruits and vegetables, we talk about color every day. And I tell him, we need to get 5 colors in your diet today. That's really the same advice I give to adults as well. So whether that color comes from a bean or a fruit or a vegetable or some sort of spice or herb, color really is tied to those really healthy components of reversal of some of these conditions. There's a lot of new studies. In fact, there are some clinical trials underway right now looking specifically at EPA, which is an omega-3 fatty acid. I talk a lot about omega-3s in the book. We know that individuals that have deficiencies of omega-3, that's a direct risk factor for the progression of NAFLD. And so having a lot of lean sources of protein, I talk a lot about that. I talk about getting enough probiotics and really strengthening the gut integrity. Obviously, there's a lot of science now looking at our gut microbiome and how that impacts the rest of the body, the liver included. And then, of course, there's some very specific studies that are related to the liver. There was a new study that just came out looking at kiwi, for example, and how that helps the liver. There's studies on green teas. Probably one of the best foods for the liver of all of them is coffee. I mean, there's probably more studies looking at coffee.
It's good for the liver?
It's not just good for the liver, it's great for the liver.
Really? Why?
And oh my gosh, so many studies. So if you look at the studies on coffee and liver health, they really point to reduced risk of liver cancer, reversal of NAFLD, lower levels of liver enzymes, reduction in fibrosis, which is inflammation of the liver, reducing mortality risk for people with liver cirrhosis. So there's so many studies. I mean, coffee is definitely, I think it's predicted to be probably the greatest source of antioxidants globally, and most likely because more people drink coffee than eat broccoli, right? That's probably why it gets that great designation. But it is one of the best foods. And so as long as you can metabolize caffeine, right, a slow versus a fast metabolizer, that's a great food to have for your liver. So I always tell my patients, I joke that everyone has a non-negotiable, that a lot of my patients walk in and I say, well, why are you here today? Well, I want to improve my dietary habits. I want to be healthy, but I'm not giving up bacon, right? Like for some people,
right.
Bacon's a non-negotiable. Don't touch it.
Well, everything's better with it, but
exactly, right? So you don't touch bacon. But many people list coffee as their non-negotiable, and that's just kind of faulty thinking because coffee should be included in all those healthy foods. So it's really about kind of cleaning up the diets, giving your body foods that the body can really thrive with and not foods that are more likely to produce inflammation, sugar, refined grains, processed meats, things like that we all know are not good for the body, and plenty of studies to direct us to avoid those things. And so it's really about how do we kind of structure this together in a way that is easy, that is fun, and also delicious. A lot of times we forget about the happiness factor when we're going on a quote-unquote diet.
So. I guess I'm kind of concerned more than anything about those 6 million kids.
Yeah, and actually there was just a new study that came out in the UK in the past week And it showed just a huge prevalence of NAFLD in teenagers in the UK. I think one of the things that we look at here, and the reason it is very concerning for kids, is that if you develop this condition, let's say in your 50s or your 60s, you know, it's a small percentage of individuals that progress to the really severe stages where you start seeing cirrhosis and you're on the liver transplant list. I do have patients like that, but it's not as big of a prevalence as we see in the condition as a whole. In children, however, if you have the condition at a very young age, let's say 6, 7 years old, you have more time on your hands. So you have more time for this to progress to those latter stages. And so that's one of the biggest conditions or concerns, rather, that we have with seeing it in the pediatric population. It is the number one liver condition that we are seeing in peds. And it is, of course, is very closely tied to obesity epidemics with pediatrics population worldwide. But it is a concern because they do have that time. They have time for this to kind of grow and fester. And if they don't change their habits early on, the likelihood of this developing and needing a new liver perhaps when they get much older is much more increased.
Well, they're certainly at the mercy of whoever feeds them.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And obviously there's studies looking at, you know, what's the weight of mom and dad and how that impacts your diets. You know, how much convenient foods are you eating versus having home cooking? Even looking at a lot of different factors, where are you getting food from? So are you getting it from school? Is it from home? So how much soda? I mean, kids are still, it's getting better, but
yeah,
we still see a high prevalence of soda drinking in children. That's a huge culprit. In fact, a study came out just a few months ago looking at soda drinking correlated with the likelihood of developing fat in the liver. So, yeah, the peds are a very important factor. I always say when someone brings a pediatric patient to me that mom or dad has to be in the room because this is going to be a diet that's going to impact the whole family, mm-hmm. not just this child, right? And so mm-hmm. hopefully we'll improve the health of every family member and everyone will live a long life to be together, as opposed to improving the child and the parents continue to deteriorate. Can't be like that.
Do you know if there's much of, I mean, we know there's a stigma around liver disease because of hepatitis and the association with alcohol and intravenous drug use that may keep some people from approaching a doctor about it. But if you're not any of those things, what sort of symptoms should you be looking for? If, you know, I mean, is there, what kind of outward symptoms, or is it by the time those emerge, it's almost too late?
Well, it's really, this is why this is a silent epidemic, because there are no real symptoms. That there's nothing like, I always say sometimes with heart disease, you'll get chest pain or things of that nature. There's nothing to kind of alert you that something is going on with your liver, not in the early stages. It's that later stage where you start getting some of those symptoms.
And what are they?
So symptoms of liver disease in general, you know, you could get some abdominal pain. Jaundice, obviously, would be a very strong symptom of liver disease. A lot of times when I see my patients with NAFLD, if they're getting to kind of the middle stages, they'll talk about a lack of energy. But a lot of people don't associate a lack of energy with something wrong with my liver. They'll
yeah.
come in and say, well, I need more B vitamins, or I'm not getting enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things could be true. But many people don't put that correlation to the liver as well. So we really don't have those symptoms until we get a little bit later on and people start saying, gosh, I've got some pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where my liver is. And by the way, they usually don't know that's where my liver is, right?
Yes.
I have pain in this area of my body and I'm going to go see my doctor. Sometimes that's one of the ways that we see this. I mean, I teamed up with a hepatologist for this book. And so I was able to shadow him and see all of the patients that go to see him for various liver diseases. And that was one symptom that just kept coming up, that it was just this gnawing pain that they realized was there.
Kristen Kirkpatrick, thanks again for joining us. Always appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Kristen Kirkpatrick is a registered dietitian and the manager for the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute. She's the author of the new book, Skinny Liver, A Proven Program to Prevent and Reverse the New Silent Epidemic, Fatty Liver Disease. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Fish and shellfish are loaded with vitamins, nutrients, protein, and the omega-3 fatty acids. Although the U.S. Dietary Guidelines for Americans suggest adults consume at least 2 servings of seafood per week, most diets fall well below that. Part of the reason is confusion about what works and what doesn't when it comes to eating fish and seafood. Carrie Shada is a food safety and health communication scholar at the Arizona State University Center for Research on Ingredient Safety. She recently wrote about guidelines for eating fish for theconversation.com. There's a link to her article on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Carrie Shada joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. It's so great to be here.
You write that Americans typically get more than enough protein, but that there isn't much variety in protein sources. Why does having variety matter?
Well, it's good to get enough protein, of course, but there's a lot of vitamins and minerals that come from a lot of the plant-based sources of protein that we don't get so much. So those are things like nuts and beans, lentils. Those have, like I said, a lot of good things in there for us that can help our health. And then on the other end of things, a lot of the animal-based sources of protein aren't as good for our health, especially the red and processed meat.
Go ahead. Well, but animal protein, when it comes from certain kinds of fish and seafood, is good.
That's correct, yeah.
In terms of health, are there certain kinds of fish or shellfish that are better than others?
Well, what I wrote about is that it's sometimes hard to make those choices, and it's a little bit of a trade-off. So if you're looking for a seafood that's a really good, healthy choice, it's good to look for something that's high in omega-3 fatty acids, but you also want to choose something that is low in mercury content, too. So that's one thing that we look for. And one of the good choices is Alaskan salmon. It tends to have really good omega-3 fatty acid profile and also is low in mercury and also tends to have good sustainability ratings as well.
Now, when you buy fish, they don't tell you what the mercury content is when you buy it, right?
True. No, they don't, yeah.
So how are you supposed to know?
Well, it's going to vary by the individual fish, so we don't know for sure, but you can look at the type and look up consumer guides about that mercury content. The FDA and EPA just recently released some consumer guidelines about what fish are high, and low in mercury content, and you can go on their website to look up that information.
Why are certain fish more prone to mercury? Is there a reason for that? Is it where you catch them, or is it the something about the nature of the fish?
It has a lot to do with the food chain. So the really large, long-lived predator fish, those are the ones that have eaten up all the little fish as time goes on, and so the mercury accumulates in their system. And then, so if we eat those fish that are the older ones and the ones that eat all the other fish, then we're going to get their mercury as well.
So smelt, sardines, those little guys, those are usually pretty good?
Yeah.
And what about the difference between farmed and wild caught? We see that in the seafood section. What is there? You said the wild caught salmon from Alaska is the best. Why is farmed not as good? Do we know?
It really depends on the type of fish. And so if we're looking at salmon, there are some forms of farmed salmon that do have good sustainability ratings. However, most of them do not. A lot of them are grown offshore in the ocean in big open pens and use a lot of antibiotics and have a lot of waste that harm the environment there.
Okay.
But there are some new systems that are being used inland that are closed that are really pretty innovative and are addressing some of those issues.
So it's not the health per se of the fish, but it's the sustainability of it that's the issue.
Primarily, yeah. Although the omega-3 content is going to vary depending on what the fish are fed.
All right. So you write that there isn't complete scientific agreement on the health benefits of omega-3 fatty acids. Tell us, what are they and what science says about why they are beneficial or not for us?
Sure. Well, it's the sort of thing that so much of nutrition, you're not going to get complete scientific agreement. And of course, you know, what we know about nutrition changes over time. And it's, of course, hard to have a really solid study that uses a randomized clinical trial to know a true causative effect. So most of the studies are done observationally. We look at what people have eaten over time and then correlate that to their health. But the most, you know, like the most conclusive evidence for omega-3 fatty acids benefit is for heart disease. Okay, and with that, it seems to be that eating the actual fish rather than just taking the fish oil seems to have the most beneficial effect.
And also, if you're eating fish sticks, like a lot of people like me were raised on during Lent, that's not what we're talking about, right? That we're talking about fish. We're talking about healthfully prepared fish.
I don't want to knock fish sticks too much, I guess. But
well, I still get an urge for them every once in a while. But
yeah, I mean, they're still going to have a good amount of protein and vitamins and minerals, of course. But, you know, they're fried, so they have that downside. But fish sticks are typically made of out of fish that isn't high in omega-3 fatty acids. So that's one of the major downsides. So it's often made of Alaskan pollock, which is one of the top seafoods eaten in the U.S., and it's still going to have some health benefits, but it's not going to have the omega-3 fatty acids.
Does the color of fish tell us anything about the omega-3 fatty, fatty acids? Are white fish going to tend to have less and a really good wild-caught Alaskan salmon have more? Does that say anything to us?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. Okay. I haven't heard that, yeah.
I just made that up. I was just curious.
No, I know. It would be such an easy way to tell, wouldn't it?
Well, like it is with vegetables, right? We just were done talking with I just finished talking with a dietitian about fatty liver disease, and we were talking, of course, it comes back, always comes back to colorful fruits and vegetables, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the ideal serving for seafood? Again, I'm using that reference to seafood. Not all fish is seafood. There are, you know, there's freshwater trout and perch and walleye and all of that kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so seafood is the general term, and then you can kind of divide it up between fish and shellfish.
Okay. And the ideal serving is 2 servings or 8 ounces per week. Is there such a thing as having too much seafood in your diet?
There's probably always a point where something is too much, but there's not an upper limit that's specified by the USDA for seafood.
And when we talk about 8 ounces, a lot of people don't have scales in their kitchen. What about how much is that? What does it look like?
Oh, geez. So I don't know that offhand, but I've heard often that, you know, looking at a serving of protein being about the size of a deck of cards. So I would probably be around that. But to be honest, I'm not sure, you know, the exact what it looks like.
You said that, you know, what spurred this in the first place? Is fish, I mean, we've talked about sustainability a little bit. In the long term, is fish a really reliable? Is it going to be out there? Is it going to be affordable for enough people?
That is a really good point. And so we have these recommendations that, you know, everyone should be eating more fish. But then if everyone does eat more fish, then what happens to our fisheries, right? It's not a good thing for them to be depleted, and then we won't have something in the future to eat. So it is a difficulty, and I think that the more that we have technological innovations to produce fish in the more sustainable inland systems, I think that better we'll be off. There's tilapia is often grown that way now, and as I mentioned, there's some new systems for salmon too.
You're calling from Arizona State University. I went to school there. I know they don't have a lot of fish everything's flown in, I would assume. Does freshness matter?
That I don't think so. A lot of stuff is flash frozen.
Okay.
That we eat. Yeah.
And EPA. And
I used to live in Hawaii, and even a lot of the stuff there is, you know, frozen. That you.
Yeah, exactly. Don't be fooled by where you live. The EPA and the FDA recently announced new mercury guidelines for fish when it comes to pregnant women. Some critics say they've done more harm than good because they've scared a lot of pregnant and nursing women away from eating fish. I know they did me when I was pregnant and nursing. What do you make of the guidelines? What should people know about those?
Well, I think the guidelines are helpful. You know, I think that people have, you know, a lot of intelligence and ability to, you know, read through what fish are good and what fish you might be beneficial to reduce during the time that you're pregnant and nursing. And so it makes it pretty clear about what's the best choice, what's a you know, good alternative or a choice to avoid during that time period.
So
it's just a matter of looking it up. And there's so many guidelines for pregnant women about what they can eat and can do. I know that is a tough thing. I've been there as well.
What are some of the fish that are at the top of the food chain that you were talking about, the predator fish? Are those like the tuna, shark? What are we talking about?
Yeah, so some of the ahi tuna and big eye tuna is up there. Swordfish, king mackerel, marlin, orange roughy, and shark. Those are common ones that tend to have a higher mercury content and that are long-lived predator fish.
So have some of it, but don't make it a regular thing.
Yeah, it's all about your choices. So, you know, especially as adults, a little bit of mercury here and there is not going to probably hurt us too much. It's really more when you eat a lot of it, and especially, as you mentioned, for you know, fetal development for young children, that's when mercury exposure is most harmful. So yeah, it's not something to be too terribly scared about, but something to just keep in mind and try to make better choices where you can.
The U.S. has made or is going to be making traceability a part of the seafood supply chain. What about that?
It's interesting because, you know, what I wrote about is you know, encouraging consumers to make informed choices about what they eat. Mm-hmm. However, it's difficult, even if you find something that's labeled a certain way, behind the scenes, there's an issue of something called seafood fraud. So there's, you know, basically what you think you're buying may not actually be what you're buying. So this new loss is a start in the right direction for helping to increase traceability. So for certain fish, importers are required to provide certain information on the producer or the harvester, like where it's where it's being imported from, whether it's caught, wild, or farmed, that sort of thing. So it's not a comprehensive regulation, but it is a start in the right direction towards reducing that problem.
Carrie Shada, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Anne. I hope everyone has a great day.
You too. Carrie Shada is a food safety and health communication scholar at Arizona State University Center for Research on Ingredient Safety. Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, AllSides interns Sarah Stacy, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.